People always say it's inner beauty that matters, not outer beauty. Well, that's not true. If it were, why would flowers put so much energy into attracting bees? And why would raindrops transform themselves into a rainbow when they encounter the sun? Because nature longs for beauty and is only satisfied when beauty can be exalted. Outer beauty is inner beauty made visible, and it manifests itself in the light that flows from our eyes. It doesn't matter if a person is badly dressed or doesn't conform to our idea of elegance or isn't even concerned about impressing other people. The eyes are the mirror of the soul and reflect everything that seems to be hidden. And like a mirror, they also reflect the person looking into them. So if the person looking into someone's eyes has a dark soul, he will see only his own ugliness. Beauty is present in all creation. But the danger lies in the fact that because we human beings are often cut off from the divine energy, we allow ourselves to be influenced by what other people think. We deny our own beauty because others can't or won't recognize it. Instead of accepting ourselves as we are, we try to imitate what we see around us. We try to be what other people think of as pretty. And little by little, our soul fades, our will weakens, and all the potential we had to make the world a more beautiful place withers away. That passage was by Paulo Coelho from his book, Manuscript Found in Accra. If you haven't read anything of his, I urge you to look for his work and try it out. Coelho has a wonderful attitude towards life and a beautiful way of expressing it. Saturday, I had a group of people from Wesleyan University, my alma mater, help to clean up the garden at the Church of the Intercession where I go to church. It ended up being a rather small group. There was one other alum that showed up, husband in tow. But the church people and some other new friends made up for that. And a great deal of trimming was done, a bit too much, actually, on the bougainvillea, but that's another story. It felt wonderful to have a dozen or more people working together on an event I'd started. Similarly, it feels wonderful to have so many of you listeners out there. Each week we get 800 or 900 downloads of the show. We'd love that you're out there listening to our great guests, and our little bits of wisdom are fun. We hope some of you will find that the show motivates you to go out into your communities and make a difference. That'd be the best possible result. And if you do, we hope you'll tell us about it, because we want to make a difference, and we're trying to do it with this show. Mike and I don't take a salary. In fact, we sometimes have to pay to keep the show on the air. We'd really appreciate some help from any of you who can do it. It doesn't have to be a lot. $5, $10, $20, $100. It's really more important that you would care enough to pitch in. And we're running a fundraiser till the end of February, and you can win a signed copy of one of Mike's books if you pitch in while it's on. Just go to the show website, http://theshow.newamericandream.info. Look in the left-hand column, you'll see a link to the fundraising campaign. I read recently about a family that fought back against the Soviets when they took over in Russia. During the purges of the 1930s, with Christianity itself under assault, a communist patrol had shot Karp Lykov's brother on the outskirts of their village. Lykov was working right beside him. He responded by scooping up his family, bolting into the forest, And he kept them isolated from the rest of the world until they were discovered in 1978, 42 years. They knew nothing of World War II, Hitler, any of that stuff. All their metal pans rusted. They had to use birch bark for cooking. They couldn't put anything on top of the fire. But they survived. Probably did better on their own than after civilization uncovered them, because within a decade after that, most of them were dead. Agafia Lykov, born in that tiny cabin, tiny one-room shack on an isolated mountain in Siberia, still lives there as a hermit today, albeit with some limited contact. It's an amazing true story and a demonstration of how strong people can be if they set their minds to something. Yet the Lykovs did not have much effect on the rest of the world. It may be that Anafia has found some sort of enlightenment by her lifelong isolation. We don't really know. We do know that other than being an object of our admiration, of our wonder, she hasn't made any difference to us. But we on this show want something more. We want to make things better. Not just run from the bad things, but change them. We think we can make a difference. Are you with us? I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream radio show. And I'm going to turn it over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome special guests Richard Flamer and Alan Mockey. Richard Flamer has been with us before, so has Alan one time, I believe. Richard Flamer is a Vietnam vet. He's a war photographer. He's a U.S. activist and many other things, and has been for the past several years working at founding and administering the Catholic Worker House in Chiapas, Mexico. Alan Mockey lives in northern Minnesota, War Road, not too far from where I am right now. He's been involved in the peace, labor, civil rights, and environmental movements for over 30 years. So tonight we are gathering for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Chiapas, Mexico, War Road, Minnesota, and wherever you are. Well, it's clear we've been lied to through our whole history over the course of our whole lives. Most of us never come to realize it. And even saying that sounds elitist, as if you are one of the chosen ones who possess the truth. But it's true, nevertheless. Most of us are hardwired with what we are taught from the very start in church, in school, on the television, on the radio, in the newspapers. And the truth is that for reasons of power and money, those things are controlled. People with power and money are some of the smartest people on the planet. They figured that out, that knowledge is power, and that if you control knowledge, you can control people. Most of us would not think of trying to control history. History just happens. But these people with power and money really think outside the box, and they came to know that anything is possible. And so they made sure they control the information. They control what people know, what they learn, and what they think. Sounds ludicrous, but it's true. And so the battle for the mind is the most important battle being fought anywhere, and it's everywhere. And thank Buddha or Alan the Alien or Jesus H. Christ, we do have some smart people on our side as well. People who have given their lives to trying to find out the truth for us so that we might not have to live entire lives based in bullshit. John Kennedy was killed almost 50 years ago, and there are dozens, probably hundreds of people who had devoted whole lives to spreading out the thousands of pieces on their kitchen tables and trying to put together that puzzle. The same with the many so-called conspiracy theory events that are the fabric of the fable that is our national history. There are good people on our side trying to find out the truth about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King murder, Oklahoma City, 9/11, Waco, the Aurora Theater shooting, and the recent event at Sandy Hook. And I'd like to draw your attention to three. No, let me see. Yeah, three bullet points. A recent interview conducted by Kevin Barrett at No Lies Radio is the first one. It's with Nick Collerstrom. The interview took place on January 29th. Barrett and Collerstrom are talking about whether the Holocaust actually occurred. That subject is supposed to be taboo, not mentioned, forbidden. But here these two educated grown men are openly talking about the big daddy of them all. Number two on my list is an article on Veterans Today where Jim Fetzer tells us what we already know in our hearts, that the whole Dark Zero 30 Bin Laden buried at sea Disney tale is a big lie. Number three is Claire Kuhn's website. Claire is a Canadian in the vein of Black Op Radio host Leno Sanic, just trying to give us a helping hand, eh? Claire Kuhn's website is youcanknowsometimes.blogspot, and she has lately been looking into the Sandy Hook event, as no paid reporters anywhere seem to want to do. And she wonders about whether some of the folks are actors, whether there was anyone killed at all. Claire and others have also given us something to chew on in that regard in relation to the 9/11 attacks, whether there were any planes at all, or if it was just a made-for-television movie that we watched like we do everything else. Well, actually, I said three. Actually, here's a fourth, another one by Professor James Fetzer on Veterans Today. It's entitled The Nexus of Tyranny, The Strategy Behind Aurora and Sandy Hook. And Fetzer asks, among other things, were there actually any children killed at Sandy Hook? Whether the whole thing is a stage-directed masterpiece by the bad guys. And that's good. That's super-de-duper. If we actually were able to talk about these things, say on the Today Show or Conan or the Daily Show or the Nightly News with Brian Williams, we would have ourselves what they call a real country. That is what would happen in a real country. Ours is something other. Here at the New American Dream, we advocate becoming a real country. Talk about everything, even in the cafe, even in church, even during supper or lunch, even in school, even at the ball game, even on the news, even in the newspaper. Go ahead. Talk amongst yourselves. This is America. Welcome, and we're glad you're here.
And now, please join us for another episode of Carl and Buster, the last of the Paper Boys. The last of the Paper Boys is sponsored every week by the good folks at Winston Cigarettes and Wild Turkey Whiskey. Now, sit back and be quiet as we zoom in on Mount Liberty, Nebraska, and the great American westernly Midwest, somewhere between Iowa and Colorado, out on the prairie. The big grain elevators, the barbed wire fence, the cows, the corn, the newspaper carriers, all that stuff.
You want some gum? Carl held out the hard gum from the baseball card package.
Nah, you go ahead, said Buster. I can't chew that stuff anymore. My teeth just can't take it.
Carl folded the gum and stuck it into his mouth, perhaps more carefully than he had before. Carl and Buster sat on their Stingray bikes outside the newspaper office door, kickstands down, leaning back, lounging on the banana seats up against the sissy bar. Carl's kickstand was actually broken. He used the parking meter for support just as well.
Carl and Buster came to work as paper boys for the Daily News back in the early 1960s when they were both in elementary school. It was a big deal. Not every kid got hired, you know. They liked the idea of having a real job, some money they actually made on their own. They talked about how they liked the fresh smell of the ink, being up close with the whole idea of the newspaper business. They saw a reporter out covering a high school basketball game or drive past the Daily News building with relatives after the big Thanksgiving meal. They could say they worked there. And over the years, well, the other kids quit. Graduated to middle school, junior high, senior high, college. Got other jobs, got married, bought a big house out in the west part of town, had kids. Carl and Buster trained lots of those kids into being good paper boys, and eventually the kids of those kids as well. The young ones won't stick with it. They stay a few months. That's usually it, until they join Little League or get a better gig shoveling snow or carrying groceries at Superfood.
But Carl and Buster loved the newspapers. Wish they could have been Charles Schultz or Jimmy Breslin or a big publisher, even a small one. But this was okay. This was a foot in the door, a part of the action. You get to read the news and sports first. Well, but of course, now everybody already knew it 9 hours ago. But still, well, shoot, they're happy. And how many people can really say that?
Buster thought once or twice about leaving, getting away from Mount Liberty, doing something different. Maybe going to Omaha or Lincoln, delivering the Journal Star or World Herald. But he didn't. Then that one year, he tried to get Carl to move with him to New York City, deliver the Times or the Post. They were going to do it, too. The whole week they talked about how they would ride their bikes to New York. They talked for another whole week about how they'd get their bikes on a bus or airplane. Then, without really deciding, they just stopped talking about it. Once they got their pictures on the front page of the Daily News on Newspaper Carrier Week, sitting on their bikes, that was a big deal. And once they got the pictures on page 5, a reprint from a story in the World Herald, as the oldest carriers in Nebraska. That was 12, 15, maybe 25 years ago now. Seemed like every day except Sunday, rainy, windy, snowy, sunny, they sit outside the Daily News gray steel back door, wait for the door to get unlocked. They take turns getting up and checking every 5 minutes or so. And then they go down and wait for their bundles to come down the metal chute. Then they work on the big metal tables, folding their papers, putting them neatly and strategically into their cloth bags that sit over their shoulders. If one gets done first, the other helps. The routes are in the same section of town, and they ride together until they get to Elm Street. Then they split up.
News nerds, they call themselves. They actually have favorite editions, like some other guys have favorite cars or football teams. Some folks know each episode of Happy Days or Gilligan's Island or the Dukes of Hazzard or the 65 Packers or Stairway to Heaven word for word. Carl and Buster know news. At home, on their bedroom walls, they have special ones, the best, most important papers in real frames.
Reggie Jackson, 4 home runs and 4 at-bats, 1977 World Series against the Dodgers, 1 game. John Lennon, shot. Mount St. Helens erupts. Vietnam War ends. Packers win the Super Bowl. Again. Man on the moon. Princess Diana killed. Bill Clinton in big trouble. The Beatles hit New York City. United States attacked.
And both of them had smack dab center right on their bedroom doors, the Daily News front page from November 23rd, 1963. Kennedy is dead.
And neither of them knows it about the bedroom door of the other guy. They don't ever talk about it. It's too sad. Too much. Just way too much.
Nobody reads papers anymore. The Daily News is getting thinner and thinner both ways, thick and sideways. Everybody is on their computer or their phone. Carl tells Buster it's because the Daily News doesn't tell the truth, never did.
Buster didn't believe that. won't listen to it. So Carl doesn't bring it up very often, maybe once a decade. But it's the truth, he says. They don't tell the truth about Oswald or Waco or Oklahoma City. JFK, RFK, MLK, or Wellstone, 9/11, or Iraq, or the moon. None of it. So people just know the only thing they tell the truth about, ninth grade football.
Buster says that's probably enough. You can only go so far, and then that's far enough. And it is nice not to have to carry such heavy papers, easier on the back, especially when a guy gets older. But it makes Carl and Buster wonder about how long they'll have their jobs, be able to go out, help the other guy go collect after dark with their punches and flip cards and heavy canvas pouches, and then be able to go spend a quarter or a dollar down at the Dairy Queen before having to get home. Talk about getting other jobs, but who would hire them? All they know is the paper biz. And so they decide to stay without ever really saying it.
They throw their paper bags stained with ink, strawberry ice cream, and cherry Coke over their heads, pedal down the street. They ride with no hands down the middle of the street until they see a car coming, ride past all the people who know them, waving, honking, smiling at them like they were in a parade. One of them once said to the other that the worst thing in the world would be if they stayed their whole life in this one place, this one town, this one job. The other said that sounded like the best thing to him.
And now they probably don't remember who said what or that it ever came up. At Fifth and Elm, they swerve apart like skiers who take different paths down the hill for a while, knowing they'll meet up at the end.
See you, says Buster.
See you later, Carl hollers, pulling on the butterfly handlebars to stand up to pedal, then letting himself back down slowly.
Tune in next week for The Last of the Paper Boys, when we'll hear Buster say, "What was that?"
And Carl says, "I didn't hear anything. Did you?"
Our first guest tonight is Richard Flamer. He'll be joining us from Chiapas, Mexico. And I'm about to call him, so you'll hear the dialing in the background. Richard is a Vietnam veteran. He spent 12 years in the 80s and 90s as a photojournalist in Central America, working for Reuters. The UN and the Catholic Church.
Hello.
Hello, Richard.
Yes.
This is Chuck Gregory, and you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I'm fine, and it's very, very nice to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure. I've been watching the news. There's an explosion in Mexico City this evening, or this afternoon.
Oh, really?
A big tower in downtown Mexico City that belongs to Pemex, the oil company.
I hadn't heard about that.
Well, I'm sure you're going to hear it tomorrow.
I'm sure we will.
Yeah. But anyway, good to talk to you. Good to listen to you. You know, I've managed to get onto your program on the internet a couple times, and it's very, very fascinating, all of them.
Well, good. We appreciate having you listen. We appreciate having everybody listen.
You know,
go ahead.
I took down some notes, and after you talked to me about coming on the show, and I thought I'd sort of run through my notes and just sort of ramble a little bit. I'm just back from the U.S., where I was for 3 months, working in construction. And it always shocks me, not when I come down here to Mexico, but when I'm up in the States, the sort of extravagance that happens in the U.S. While I was there, I was talking to a lady who had just spent $1,900 on a surgery for her dog. Something about the dog had a brain tumor, and so they did some sort of, you know, surgery on it and whatever. And it got me to thinking, we have a little dog here, a little black dog that my wife, it feeds everybody and everything. So this dog sort of stays around here all the time. And then of late, the dog has gotten cataracts, so he can't see very well. He's an older dog, and that's okay. At the same time that he's going blind, there's a family up in Austin, Texas, that's paying $1,900 for a brain surgery for a dog. I don't understand it. I mean, we just spent $300 on rice and beans. Rice and beans are a staple of the Mexican diet. And there's a group of 200, mostly women and children, who were thrown off their lands by a local landowner who wanted more land. There's an arrest warrant out for the guy, the landowner, but he's on ejido or communal lands. And under federal law, the state police can't go onto the land because it's supposed to be run by the ejido, the people in the little communal lands. So this guy's staying on the land so he can't be arrested, so he's just taking over all the property. And in the meantime, there's over 200 Indian people who have just been thrown off the land. And the people are camped out in San Cristobal in sort of main, just makeshift tents. And they're fed mostly by the diocese. The local Catholic Church has gotten money together, and they're cooking out in front of the church with big pots of rice and beans. And somehow there's a discordance between these 200 people camped out in front of a church, and it only costs $300 for the rice and beans for all of them, but the family struggled to get it. And the concept of a dog, somebody spending $1,900 on a friggin' dog, I just don't get it.
Much as I love dogs, that would be 6 months, more than 6 months to feed all those people.
Right. Exactly. And I love dogs. I mean, we have dogs. But on the other hand, there comes a point when I go, oh, this dog who's gone blind is doing fine. I mean, he's fatter than he ever was before. he stays around the house. He barks at anybody who comes near. And that seems to me to be just fine. That's the way the laws of nature are. And he seems to be doing just great. Now, I wouldn't want to be a street dog here. But on the other hand, this dog is doing just fine. And that sort of leads into this. I've been reading two books at the same time, one of which was by Robert Taft on the history of the conflicts in the Middle East. He's an Englishman who's been living in Beirut for more than 25 years. And he writes of George Bush, Ronald Reagan, the Twin Towers, but more importantly, U.S. and British policy. And I was always reminded of a comment by Malcolm X on the death of John Kennedy. When somebody asked him what he thought, he said, "Looks like the chickens came home to roost." And you pay for violence. You pay for the military. Something's going to happen. It's got to come back to haunt you. And my own sense is that certainly in the Middle East, U.S. policy has just been abhorrent. It's just been awful. And it's so the lies and the perversions that the U.S. has continued to do in the Middle East in propping up these dictators. I mean, Saddam Hussein at one point is the great savior, and so the U.S. sells him poison gas to use against the Iranians. And then he becomes the Hitler when it comes to later years. And I'm reminded of Noriega in Panama, who was the CIA man for years and suspected in the killing of Torrijos, General Torrijos, who was the leader of Panama, the actually freely elected leader. And then Noriega came to power, and then he was the CIA man, and then when his britches got too big for him, the U.S. went after him, and then he became this evil man. But all of that, in reading Taft and going through that, one of the big things that interests me is how he has been on the ground and living with the poor, working with the poor, working with those people who've been affected by those U.S. policies. And simultaneously, I'm reading a book called Betrayed by Linda Diebel about the death of Digna Ochoa, who was a human rights lawyer here in Mexico, who was well known in the States, largely because of a book by Carrie Kennedy. And she won several awards and so on for her civil rights work, her human rights work. And she was deserving of all those awards. That's not an issue. I think she did a great job. I didn't have a chance to meet her, but I heard her talk several times in Mexico City. But the author, Linda Diebel, is from Toronto and is a reporter in Toronto, Canada. And she seems much more secure in the halls of bureaucracy and the non-governmental agency offices and the government offices, and much less secure in talking to the poor and dealing with the poor. So it's kind of fascinating for me to see the two sides of this stuff with someone like Linda Diebel writing a book. I'm not saying that it's a bad book, only that her perspective is one that's a first world. You know, it's like, wait a minute, she followed all the rules. Why did they kill her? and she's constantly wondering, and she can't understand. And it's obvious because she's never lived in a third world country. And Robert Taft, on the other hand, writes about from the perspective of the poor. And in that sense, it's a much more valuable lesson, certainly for me. And then in general, I've just been trying to get on track here with living a life day to day. As I get older, my back hurts more.
I know what you mean there.
But
I don't end up doing all of the physical labor that you do. Can you remind our listeners what the Chiapas Project actually is and what you do down there?
Yeah, essentially, we're a Catholic worker of sorts, and every Catholic worker is different. They all do different things. We try to live with the poor, and all Catholic workers are designed to be places of community, of building community and resistance to the powers that be. And sometimes that includes the church, the Catholic Church. But basically, our particular Catholic worker, the Chiapas Project, we run a little farm and we work with the neighbors around us. We have a development. We've been developing projects on the farm, which can help the people in the community where we live. The community itself is 80 families, 35 of which are headed by single women, the men having gone north, some to northern Mexico, some to the U.S. Nobody really knows what happens to a lot of those people. A woman will say goodbye to her husband and won't hear from him for 2 years, sometimes never hears from him. They get caught along the way. They find a job in a border city sometimes. Sometimes they get across and are afraid to make communication back. Sometimes they get killed in the desert. Many of them, we've accepted over the last 5 years, probably 7-8 bodies of men who've gone north and died in the process of trying to get across. We also work with a Guatemalan, mostly Guatemalan, but some Honduran and some Ecuadorian migrants who come through. We're just 3.5 hours from the Guatemalan border. And there's a lot of violence on the border, especially directed against women and girls. And every time they have a national problem in, say, Guatemala, a number of people head north and try to get away, either for economic reasons or in some cases where their whole village has disappeared or they can't find relatives. And up until about a year ago, we were taking in mostly girls who'd been raped and beaten on the border, and they were pregnant. And so we helped them have their children here and then placed them with families around southern Mexico, mostly my wife's relatives. And then along the way, we work with other small communities, small poor communities. And I've been working a lot with, because of my wife, we've been working at building up a school in the little area where we are, literally building. She got the Secretary of Education in Chiapas to build a new classroom. So I've been doing putting electrical into each of the school buildings, which now makes them eligible for a Bill Gates grant of computers and a satellite dish to make computers available to all the kids. So we do sort of a mixed lot. And we're essentially trying to serve the people around us. And in order to fund that, I go up to the States and work construction for 3 or 4 months. And then sometimes I go beg and work at other Catholic workers and get to be a part of that larger experience as well. And I put out fundraising efforts from time to time, but usually I have I'm collecting a small amount of Social Security, and then more importantly, I have a 40% disability from the Veterans Administration for some injuries suffered in Vietnam. So that money that I get from Social Security and the VA just about covers our monthly expenses, and the rest comes from donations of decent people who want to help. So that's briefly what we do.
It's a great effort, and you are one of those people that I was talking about at the beginning of the show, people who are out there making a difference, and we really appreciate that, Richard. I'm afraid we're out of time tonight, but I'm not going to let it be another 6 months going by. We're going to get you on within a couple of months because you have a unique perspective. It's really something hearing the stories from Mexico instead of from the United States.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Yep.
Have a good night.
Okay. Good night.
The mind of an American rules the world. President, Warren Buffett, Tiger Woods, Katie Couric, John Stewart, the Michelin Man. No, stupid, it's you. You are king of the world, God, Superman, King Midas, all that. It's you. You are more than just a legend in your own mind. You are the man. And when the CIA, through the CIA propaganda machine called Radio Free Europe or the American Free Press, tells you the Russians are coming or the criminals are coming or terrorists or the Iranians or Iraqis or Afghans on nuclear-powered blue donkeys or big bees and you believe it, well then, Zeke, that's how the world will go. You are powerful, the most powerful Yahoo who has ever lived in the history of living. No Roman citizen Yahoo had it over you, you big galoot, and you are an idiot, and the world is going to burn. You might not be an idiot on purpose, but an idiot nonetheless. The CIA, the persons in the CIA are smart, but they are evil, the actual evil empire, and they control you, the most powerful person in the world. If you were not an idiot, they could not do that. But you are an idiot, and that's a bummer, man. That's a bummer.
And now we bring you the New American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater something something.
Real voices with a message that you will not hear on the Today Show, Fox News, National Public Radio, CBS Nightly News, or the Sunday morning political talk shows.
Mike Prisner, Iraq War veteran. The real enemies are not in some distant land. They're not people whose names we don't know and cultures we don't understand. The enemy is people we know very well and can identify. The enemy is a system that wages war when it is profitable. The enemy is the CEOs who lay us off from our jobs when it is profitable. The insurance companies who deny us health care when it is profitable. It's the banks who take away our homes when it is profitable. Our enemy is not 5,000 miles away. They're right here at home. If we organize with our sisters and brothers, we can stop this war. We can stop this government. We can create a better world.
And now we hear the voice of Philip F. Nelson, author of LBJ, the mastermind of JFK's assassination.
The man should be known for what he was, a world-class criminal. A thorough cleansing of the national conscience is in order after all these years to enable Americans to reconcile the personal tragedy suffered by John F. Kennedy and the national tragedy suffered by the country at large at the hands of Lyndon B. Johnson. Until the real story of the 36th president is exposed and the complete truth of his crimes against the United States and the world are acknowledged, there will always be questions lurking about the trustworthiness of the government itself.
And finally, the voice of William Pepper, attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, now attempting to be released from prison for the 1968 murder of Robert Kennedy on grounds that Sirhan was programmed to be a patsy and a decoy for the real killers in the Ambassador Hotel pantry that hot summer night.
The American people have been called by numbers of people all over the world as being the most dumbed-down population in Western civilization. Certainly, they're probably among the least politically and other ways sophisticated people in Western culture. It's no accident. And it's no testimony to the lack of intelligence and potential of the citizens of this republic. It's a testimony to the control of thinking and the flow of information that people are allowed to have. The effect of the media and the thought control that has been developed in this country is extraordinary, and it's very difficult to overcome. One wonders how long it's going to take for the uprising to occur. I actually think we may be reaching a point where we're entering a pre-revolutionary stage.
Now I'd like to bring on our second guest, Alan Maki. Alan has been with us once before, and we tried last week also, but things just didn't work out. But Alan is with us tonight. Alan Maki is a northern Minnesota activist who has been involved in the peace, labor, civil rights, and environmental movements for over 30 years. Beginning tonight, he'll be joining us as a monthly columnist. Alan, if you are there, hello and welcome, and please take it away.
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. Tonight I'd like to talk about jobs and unemployment and poverty. You know, when we listen to all these politicians running for office, all they talk about is jobs, jobs, jobs. But, you know, we have to ask, where are these jobs that they're talking about? Our governor here in Minnesota, a reporter asked him when he was running for office, what are the three main things that you're concerned about? And his answer was jobs, jobs, jobs. That was Mark Dayton's answer to that question. But, you know, with all this talking coming out of Washington and from the state houses, as well as all the hype from the overpaid economist and all these big media pundits, they all talk about jobs, but where are those jobs? There isn't a single politician that runs for office in this country right now that doesn't promise jobs. But none of these politicians, none of these pundits, none of these economists, none of them are talking about a full employment economy. And that's what we got to begin to speak about, full employment. Back in 1945, the labor movement and the progressive movement in this country was pushing for the Full Employment Act of 1945, which would have made the United States government responsible for full employment in this country. And what we mean by full employment, not 4 or 5% unemployment. What we're talking about is employment, full employment, so that anybody that wants a job has a job. That's the definition of full employment. A New York Times columnist, Bob Herbert, wrote a column a little while back called Losing Our Way. And this is just a short paragraph from his article. And you can see it on my blog, the entire article. He said, the U.S. has not misplaced its priority. The U.S. has not just misplaced its priorities. When the most powerful country ever to inhabit the earth finds it so easy to plunge into the horror of warfare, but almost impossible to find adequate work for its people or to properly educate its young, it has lost its way entirely. And I think that's an important statement and something we have to begin to speak about and talk about around our kitchen tables and our living rooms to our friends and neighbors and the people that we work with. Because these wars, they kill jobs the same way they kill people. How much longer can we continue to plunge the wealth and the resources of our country into these wars and then have these politicians talk about jobs? We can't pay for job-creating programs while we're paying for these wars. It's just common sense. You know, the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve a while back said that normal unemployment in this country was going to remain at 8.7%. That's from the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve. That means we're going to have tens of millions of people in this country permanently unemployed. That doesn't include the people that are underemployed, the people that are working at poverty wage jobs. You know, this is a crime of capitalism, and we've got to begin to talk about this. You know, how come the words full employment never appear in what all these economists and media pundits say? The reason we don't hear about full employment is because we, the people of the United States, the working people, are not demanding this conversation. We have to begin to demand the conversation about full employment. That's all there is to it. Here in Minnesota, with all these politicians talking about jobs, 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 they allowed the politicians who have subsidized the Ford Motor Company, the St. Paul Twin Cities Assembly Plant, they subsidized this plant to the hilt with our tax dollars. They even provided the Ford Motor Company with free electricity for 85 years. Taxpayers built them a hydro dam on the Mississippi River to provide the free electricity. And yet now they're going to bulldoze this plant over. 2,000 people are at work. The politicians did nothing to save these jobs. Nothing. So when they talk about jobs, 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 these politicians are just plain hypocrites. And we have to begin to challenge these politicians. There was an article in the Christian Science Monitor in October, and it said, in fact, most of the new jobs seen since the economic crisis and most of what will come in the next decade are low wage, according to the National Employment Law Project. More than 40% of the jobs added to the economy between 2008 and 2010, the first 2 years of the recession, were low-wage jobs. The project reported in August, 6 of the 10 jobs projected to see the most growth by 2020 are also low-wage jobs. And then it goes on, the long view of wages is even bleaker. Since 1979, the American economy has lost about one-third of its capacity to generate good jobs. And then they go on to say a good job, in this case, pays about $37,000 a year and offers health insurance and retirement benefits, two things most low-wage jobs lack. Now, you know, Barack Obama just made a big inauguration speech, and he talked about jobs, too, in that speech. But what he didn't talk about, he didn't talk about full employment just like the rest of the politicians. They're afraid of this word, full employment. They're just totally afraid of it. They're afraid to confront the reality that this system, this capitalist system, cannot have full employment. In fact, these politicians and the economists, they're all saying that the economy needs some unemployment. Why do they want unemployment? Because unemployment, these large pools of unemployed people, this drives all wages down. We've seen it here in the Red River Valley. Unemployment is the best union buster and best strike breaker that Wall Street has. Workers were locked out of the sugar producing facility over here in the Red River Valley, American Crystal Sugar Company. 1,300 workers were locked out of the job because the company tried to force a union contract on them that wasn't, reasonable. Right away, they brought in scabs to do those jobs. 1,300 workers have been out of work for over a year and a half. So, you know, this unemployment is being used in a terrible way, pitting workers against workers, and we got to put an end to it. Anybody can go to my blog and see the Full Employment Act of 1945. The United States Senate overwhelmingly passed this Full Employment Act of 1945, and Wall Street ganged up on Congress and the House members to defeat this. The Full Employment Act of 1945 would have made the United States government responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment. And think about this. What good is a government if a person can't even get a job? This is something we got to begin to think about. It's just like Bob Herbert said, what kind of government pumps, you know, all this money into wars but can't provide its own people with jobs, living wage jobs? This is a terrible situation. Wright Patman, a congressman from Texas, is the one that introduced the Full Employment Act of 1945. You know, all we get from these Wall Street politicians and the Democratic and Republican parties is this talk, 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 instead of jobs, jobs, jobs. They do nothing. They're not accountable to the American people for what they talk about because we're not holding them accountable. We have to begin to hold these people accountable. In Canada, they have the New Democratic Party. This is a labor party. We need to begin to look at alternatives right here in this country. Working people need their own political party to advance an agenda that will create a full employment economy. There's no reason we can't have a full employment economy. There's all kinds of things that need to be done in this country. We hear all these politicians talk about health care. Obama passed his Obamacare. But if they really wanted to create jobs, all they had to do is implement a national public health care system in this country. They could have provided all the American people with free health care. Plus, they could have created 12 million new jobs providing health care at all community and neighborhood health care centers for all the American people. Instead, we have 800 military bases all over the world. So we got to think about what this Wall Street imperialism is doing to us. These wars, the militarism, it's robbing us, literally robbing us of health care, and it's robbing us of jobs. There's things that you can do. You know, we got to raise this issue, the issue of full employment. We got to make it a public issue. The way to do that is begin to write letters to the editor, talk to your friends and neighbors, hold little meetings, discuss this, and, you know, hold picket lines, demonstrations. When you see these politicians and you hear them talking about jobs, we should have signs there. Where's the jobs? Where's the full employment? This is the way we win these kinds of things. Working people will not get anything from this government if we don't stand up and fight for it. We've seen this over and over again. I was at a demonstration, and I saw a woman carrying a sign. And she said, her sign said, "The only war I support is the war on poverty." And I said, 50 million people without health care, 45 million people living in poverty. Think about this. Why do we have poverty in this country? This is a question we got to ask. Don't we have poverty because people are unemployed and because people aren't being paid living wages for the jobs that they're doing? Think about this. If a person doesn't have a job, if a working person does not have a job, they are going to be poor. Simple as that. And this is something we got to make these politicians understand. Right now, 9.5 million families are living in poverty in the United States. The U.S. Census Bureau released the latest official poverty figures, putting the number of poor people at 46.2 million, or 15% of the population in this country. You know, this is the wealthiest country in the world, and we've got this kind of poverty, and the poverty is growing. This is criminal. It's insane. The government is not working for the people, and we've got to create a government that works for the people. We're going to have to remove Wall Street from their position in power where they're making all these economic decisions, because this government, these bribed politicians bribed by Wall Street, are not making the kind of decisions that are in the interest of working people in this country. And we're the majority. We're the people that create all the wealth. You know, this is an article from the Wall Street Journal itself. It says, prospects for a stronger upturn, at least in the first half of 2013, remain slim. Many economists worry about losing even more ground, especially as lawmakers launch a potentially risky political battle this winter over raising the federal debt ceiling. The U.S. economy grew at an average annual rate of 3.6% from 1950 through 1999, but has since slowed to less than 2%. Since the recession ended 3.5 years ago, they say it ended, economists have been divided over long-term growth prospects after the downturn pushed millions of Americans out of the labor force. Looking forward 5 to 10 years, the argument goes, annual U.S. growth may reach a ceiling of 3% and unemployment could settle at a rate above the 5.7% annual average recorded during the last half of the 20th century. You know, this is from the Wall Street Journal. We heard before the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve said unemployment could stabilize, be normal at over 8%. Millions of people are unemployed. No reason. You know, the government of this country should implement a Works Progress Administration. The WPA did great things during the 1930s. We should have a CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, restoring our forest. You know, none of these things are being looked at by these politicians. None of them. And, you know, it's time to start pushing these politicians in Washington and in our state legislatures to start creating jobs, the jobs that they promised when they're running for office. You know, and I think it's important that we stress that we have to end these wars and occupations, because these ending the wars will yield huge, huge peace dividends that we can use to begin to do the kinds of things we need in this country, like establish a national public health care system, 12 million jobs. We could have a national public child care system, 3 to 5 million jobs. These are things that people need. We don't need to be at war with all these other countries. If we can't derive from the peace dividend enough to pay for these programs, we have to start talking about taxing the rich, taxing corporate profits, and taxing the Wall Street transactions. John Conyers proposed a piece of legislation to create a training program and jobs program, and he's proposing taxing these Wall Street transactions, too, for that program. You know, this is a good idea, and we got to begin to support those kind of things. So I hope people will start to consider these things and check out my blog. You can Google my name, Alan Mackey, and it's A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and you'll find the Podunk blog and a link on the upper right-hand corner to my blog on full employment. So until next month, you know, I hope you'll begin to think about these kinds of things. You know, yours in the struggle and in solidarity, keep on fighting.
Thank you, Alan. Have a good night.
You too.
Funding for tonight's program is provided in part by GoBarbaraBush.com, as well as the United States Navy, a global force for good. The United States Army, be all you can be. The United States Air Force, peace is our profession. And the United States Marines, the few, the proud, the brave, because we could never sell you the truce.
And also by your local Down Home, just like you, we're all in this together for mom, for pie, for baseball, and for Chevrolet, military recruiter. Stop on in now and talk about who you want to kill most of all, and we'll sign some papers and get you started on your programming, turning you from who you are now into a crazed, mind-controlled American killer.
And also by the good folks at Shop and Flop Indoor Porta Potties for the busy American shopper. We know you're always on the run all day long, round and round, buying stuff to keep your favorite Americans happy. But sooner or later, you're going to need a pit stop. Why not? Shop and Plop.
Shop and Plop. Take some time out to sit in your own little world, inches from the hurried masses around you, brushing against the wall while you hold on tight. You hear their conversations. Who's a bitch and who shot what? While you search in the dark for the paper roll, you hold on to both walls, wondering if some teenage swarm might decide to tip you over.
You reach out your foot to touch all your expensive, hard-won packages to make sure your whole day, your whole life was not wasted. You smile. It's all good. We're on the same page, taking it to the next level. Then you hear the satisfying plop in the communal goo, and you're ready to continue to push on, to persevere in your pursuit of the American dream.
You emerge refreshed and victorious to join your fellow Americans, some standing in line glaring at you, some rushing past brandishing razor-sharp elbows, and you smile, and for a moment you pause to adjust those heavy bags cutting into your arms, and you nod knowingly, now realizing for perhaps the first time such clarity why we killed those millions of Indians and those millions of Iraqi children and all those poor people in Afghanistan.
You step down as from a throne as the next person takes your hand to allow you to set your blistered foot once again on the mall tile floor. Terra firma. One small step for mankind. You gracefully bend your leg to pull the paper from your shoe. You smile at the waiting line as a movie star to adoring fans. Shop and Plop. It's the American way to go. Look for the handy blue and yellow plastic huts in the middle of the mall.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Kate King is the daughter of Jack Robert King, and Cherry King and Johnny King was her brother. A while back, you might recall, you might not, that Jack Robert King took his online podcast radio show on the road. He rode a bus from Nebraska to Oregon, but he wasn't going to Oregon to see if he could just have a Bigfoot experience. He also wanted to find out the truth about America. He just felt in his gut that he didn't know the whole story, and he had to know. Well, he found out at least something, at least more than he knew before. And what we do know is that after he returned, well, a few weeks or months later, he and Cherry and Johnny were dead, and the radio show was no more. Little Kate saw the whole thing. She saw it all, and she ran. She ran into the corn that afternoon, and she lived. And she suffered, and she survived, and she learned. And today, she's very, very angry, and very, very beautiful, and very, very capable, and so very alive.
The only problem with the running of the nation was the girl who had lived. The family lay in the road, in the gravel and dust, in their own blood. The three sprawled in not human poses, arms and elbows, legs sprayed out as if forced into unnatural forms by the men who made the nation. The father and mother and brother, with their faces covered in blood, noses shoved into the black earth, eyes and mouths open, filled with mucus and wonder and disbelief. Just as it should be. If the little girl had died, all would be well. All would be awesome. The nation's gears growled, screamed, enormous and oiled, cleverly meshed, showing signs of human genius. They ran and never stopped, but that could not go on forever. Because the girl had lived and she grew stronger. Her bones and her blood would one day become stronger even than gears and oil and grease. They beat and they grew and they knew, because that's what bones and blood can do. The little girl ran at first, but only for a while. She would turn and face her pursuers. Then they would become afraid because they saw the green steel in her eye. Those who ran the nation looked for her every day, all the time. The work continued. Every dawn of a new day in the nation dripped with immense possibility. Now the little girl was almost grown. She stalked the nation, circled its campground in the night like an undiscovered wild animal.
Kate walked into the quick stop and rushed to the pens by the gum. At the counter, she stood behind two women waving little flags in front of their faces, whispering about the big parade. Without looking, Kate opened the plastic wrapper, slicing it with a red fingernail. She measured where the one woman's spleen might be through her thick corduroy coat. The women giggled at each other and the clerk and moved off out the door. Kate stepped up, now eyeing the plastic jar by the register that asked people to donate for a holiday package for the troops. Kate took her new red pen and drew a swastika on the white paper. Unsure if the cross's E's were quite right, she shrugged. The young man behind the counter watched her and said, $1.47. Kate picked up her guitar case and left. On the walk, she adjusted down her white twins cap with blood-red lettering, and straightened her black cape with another oomph of her shoulders. Kate moved on with long, powerful, limping strides, back straight, eyes ahead. When passing men and boys stopped to stare, she acted as if she did not notice.
The crowd on the curbs grew like a swarming beehive. Soon the low sun would turn its back and leave snipers to their business. A shocking fire engine horn blared somewhere down the street. The motorcade would not be long now. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the spot and went for it, glad for the chance to rest her burning leg. Kate found her perch all planned out weeks ago after she read about the big visit. She stopped letting the hurried foot traffic find its path around her. Kate sat on the curb and rubbed dirt off her favorite red tennis shoes. She leaned back against the barren, round concrete planter and opened the guitar case flat on the sidewalk off one side of her. On the other side, she set her coffee, staking a steaming claim to the space. She drew her weapons from the case, setting the white-page notebook and sleeve of pens on the walk. She closed the case and set it down just so that on one side across the street, the people with their flags could see the 9/11 with an inside job sign in red ink and black border on white paper. And the folks behind her saw, "This machine kills fascists."
With pens, red, blue, black, green, purple, now in her hands, behind her ears, in her mouth, on the sidewalk, in the street, Kate took her left hand and touched the clean white pad pressed against one bent knee, aimed down the street. She sighted over the pad and began to sketch the wide street, the crowds on both sides, each leaning to get a look around the next person. The walkway over the street connecting the corporate bookstore to the city bank building. Kate drew big, dark clouds overhead, and inside the clouds, big, thick, black words around the edges of her canvas. Doom, despair, poverty, war, unfairness, misery, deceit.
On her side of the street, she gave birth to a family standing together, exchanging looks of anticipation with each other. The far end of the street and struggling police lights. The mother, father, son, and daughter appeared Neanderthal. Low, deep brow ridges over the eyes, like caves. They sprouted tufts of hair in unlikely places, on the backs of their wrists, on their faces. Each wore either a gold or silver cross around their necks on a chain. They wore red, white, and blue buttons on their white, shirted chests that said, "Murder." They darted nervous monkey looks all around, and swayed their long arms, whispering, hissing, "Murder, murder, murder." In their big, hairy hands, they sloppily held American flags on tiny sticks. Kate adjusted her bottom on the cool cement, curled her toes inside her shoes, staring yet harder at her paper world. She would have said, she liked your green eyes, like green lanterns, fiery gems, fiendish, inquiring. The one open and laughing, the other devilish. She tugged at her cap and narrowed her eyes, aiming a laser down the street. Children dashed back and forth, gaining advantage over rivals for candy tosses. There would be no candy today. Kate had silently given herself the nickname Avenger. She considered getting a superhero tattoo on her lower back, or maybe on her neck. Kate's long hair glistened thick and black. She had a cheerleader homecoming queen face with revolutionary Russian coffee shop eyes, erotic, piercing, doubting.
Her black cape buttoned around her neck. She wore black half gloves, home-fashioned, cut off at the knuckles. She wore her cap proudly. It was her dad's, white with red twins letters, adjustable. The cover of her worn artist pad pictured a stick person drawing in ink a large Bigfoot. On the first inside page was another sketch, more like a child's doodling, of a group of three people stretched on a road with a helicopter above them and dot bullets raining from it. A cornfield runs along the road, and a stick figure little girl stands in the corn with dots of tears falling down her face. Kate drew the new red pen from her mouth. On the top of her fresh drawing, she wrote, in giant letters, "Vengeance." large letters across the page, a banner headline. She underlined it and then again and again. She filled in the letters and traced them again, wider, deeper, darker. Three black and white police cars appeared under the walkway, side by side across the street, lights flashing. Behind them came a light phalanx of fire engines with horns blaring, honking like inherently angry geese.
They sat for a moment beneath the walkway, where an enterprising rifle person should be sitting, aiming, squeezing off round after round, thought Kate. But the thick glass was vacant. Shatterproof, likely. Triple ply. Truth resistant. Kate filled in the scene on her pad as quickly as she could manage, switching colors in a flurry, not noticing a group that had formed behind her, blowing breath puffs, like a cattle yard in January, pawing, digging into cement with cold feet, stuffing hands deeper into pockets, leaning hunched shoulders forward to see what the street artist was doing. "He's not very good," the girl told her father, who shrugged, looked up at the new sound. A cheer, a crescendo, a wave of voices rolling, crashing, breaking along both sides of the street. The police cars and fire engines and horns and lights inched forward, gradually revealing a third layer, a four-wide cabal, shoulder-to-shoulder black limousines with tiny American flags fluttering from the front quarter panels. Kate tried to stare a laser beam into the closed, darkened windshields of the vehicles, but still, they kept coming. Kate drew carefully as best she could, hurrying, sweating, needing to stop the progress of the parade. She concocted a woman standing in the middle of the street, fists dug hard into her sides, feet wide, staring straight into the flashing lights of the oncoming motorcade parade. A black cape fluttered from her shoulders, her long black hair stretched out behind her likewise in the steady northwest breeze. She showed off a Bigfoot tattoo around her belly button. She wore a red mask over her eyes and black lipstick and rings on seven of her fingers. She wore cherry red tennis shoes and jeans torn at the knees. Her white tight T-shirt pictured an American flag, and in bold, thick red letters, Progressive Avenger. Kate drew more slowly. She smiled at her work. She placed a shoulder rocket launcher on the superhero's bicep and did not notice a black and white police car pulled to the curb with lights flashing just behind her.
Kate shot laser beams from the Avenger's eyes, striking down stick figure cops with badges and hats in the street, bleeding dots and dashes. She did not hear the police man and woman with drawn weapons moving through the crowd around her. Kate pulled a green pin from her ear and made another laser beam shoot from the Progressive Avenger's green eyes into the longest, blackest limousine, still walking forward. The green beam penetrated the windshield and the vehicle exploded, caught fire, sending burning bodies in suits flying through the air. Okay, that's enough.
Kate did not hear the policeman behind her. The Progressive Avenger sent green rays into the other vehicles, and they exploded. "Hey, you come with us." The policeman grabbed Kate under her arms and dragged her to her feet. The people gathered around, cheered and clapped and pounded their feet on the sidewalk. The policewoman fell to her hands and knees to gather Kate's scattered pad and pens and tossed them into the guitar case. She closed it and brought it with her. She stood holding it next to Kate and her partner, next to the clothing store on the walk. You need to go to the free speech zone, ma'am, said the policeman. Over there by the tracks. He pointed toward an area a block away where Kate could see people holding signs. The whole country's a free speech zone, Zeke, said Kate. Can I have that? She reached for a guitar case. Thank you. She shook the case to hear the rattling of the pens inside. You can't stop me from being here, said Kate. Yes, we can. The female officer moved in, took Kate by one arm. A television crew set up on the sidewalk as the two officers began to wrestle with Kate. She fought them, trying to free her arms, leaning back against the brick building, letting the guitar case go. Some walkers stopped to watch. Let me go, said Kate. With her right arm, she slammed the woman in the throat, smashing her head against the brick building. Directing her attention to the male officer on her left, she was able to swing with both hands. She struck him in the face with a flurry of elbows and fists, nose, eyes, mouth, chin. The television reporter signaled her cameraman to begin filming the fight behind them. The woman officer pulled herself from the sidewalk and climbed onto Kate's back. Kate stood up and turned, slamming her rider again into the unforgiving bricks. The TV camera shined bright in the dusk. The light caught Kate full in the face. She could see on the edges the forms and shapes of a crowd. Behind it, the motorcade with horns blaring, more flashing flags waving. The crowd roared its approval of the limousines and the parade as the story developed behind their backs. The woman cop wilted. Arms and hands from the crowd reached in toward Kate, like ghouls in a nightmare. Kate snatched up her case and charged through the mass. Later that night, the 10 o'clock news broadcast showed Kate darting, dodging, stumbling, running, and getting away with her cape streaming.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
That wraps up another New American Dream radio show. We thank you for joining us. We hope you'll be back next week. Same time, same place. And thank you, Mike. Good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.